Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
And it will look like a spider cracking like in a window or something like that, but those points, if it's bad enough, though, that means that those parts are about to fall out. Like they literally, like I've had it where guys brought casting brace from a certain manufacturer here, and you pull on the front casting brace and the whole front cap just comes off the boat.
That was Justin Weinberg with a great tip on knowing what to look for in a used fiberglass drift boat. The bonus drift boat season keeps rolling on. This is the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today. We'll help you on your fly fishing journey with classic stories covering steelhead fishing, fly tying, and much more.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. If you get a chance, head over to wetflyswing.com/Facebook to join our private community and ask some questions of upcoming guests. Justin Weinberg is here to share the story of Adipose Boatworks and the background on fiberglass boats and the river skiff. Justin shares some background on how they build the skiff, what popular accessories are available, and some tips on finding a used boat. We dig into a lot of things here, including a little story on Justin's background in the Army. Really interesting to hear the transition there. So, without further ado, here is Justin Weinberg from AdiposeBoatworks.com.
How's it going, Justin?
Good. How are you, Dave? I really appreciate you having me on here today.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. This is going to be pretty fun. We're going to dig into some more on boats. We're doing a drift boat season. The cool thing is we've got the drift boat season and we've got the fishing, because you guys are obviously hitting it pretty good with some of the, you know, the skiffs and some of the boats you guys have going. So we're going to talk about that whole story. But maybe before we get to the Adipose story, just talk about how you first got into like fly fishing and found yourself in like boats and boat building.
Yeah, so I grew up in West Michigan, and where I grew up, fishing in Michigan is pretty big, and so a lot of it was just still water stuff. And so growing up, fished for a lot of panfish and a lot of bass, and that kind of stuck with me all through my younger years, through high school and beyond. When I was 14 years old, I came out to Montana and visited an uncle who has aunt and uncle who have a place right by Reynolds Pass Bridge on the Madison, and we went fishing there, fly fishing for the first time, and we did two different days, walkwayed and different stuff. And then one evening during a caddis hatch, I caught like a nice 17-18 inch brown on a dry fly, and I was hooked. I distinctly remember we were walking back to the car to go back home that night, and I looked at my dad and I said, I'm going to move here. And I was 14 at that time, and life went on, and I joined the Army when I was 17 years old. In between my junior and senior year of high school, I went to basic training and then came back, finished out my senior year, and then went into the National Guard and did a six-year contract with the National Guard. And during those 6 years, I did 3 years active duty, and I did a deployment to Iraq in 07-08 and got back from that. And I got engaged, and my fiance at the time was graduating from University of Michigan, and she knew that she wasn't going to be able to find a job in Michigan because the unemployment rate was 22% there. And so she was applying for all spots all over the country for a new job. And she asked me if you could live anywhere, where would you want to live? And I said, Montana. And so she got a job in Montana. Luckily, out of about 400 jobs she applied for, she got one here, and we just picked up and moved everything pretty quickly. And then when I got out here, I was finishing up my contract with the Army and doing a little bit of construction, and I got laid off because it was a slow season. And I was perusing Craigslist one night, and I saw a job for lamination work. And I had no idea what lamination work was, but I know how to work with my hands and I know how to build stuff. And so I called the number, just expecting, it was like 8:30, and I was just expecting to leave a voicemail. Someone answered, and it ended up being the owner of the company, Mike Ward. And I just told him who I was, and he said, yeah, come down tomorrow for an interview at 9. I did an interview that day. The next day I called and asked if there's anything I could do to kind of help out and any info they needed and stuff. And they said they'd let me know by the end of that day. And they called me around 3 o'clock and told me I got the job. And so at that time I was really just getting into fly fishing pretty, this was June of 2010. So I'd moved to Montana in February of 2010, and I was really fishing as much as I could at that point, and fly fishing, I should say. And then, yeah, once I got hired on here as Adipose as a laborer, I was sleeping floors and building boats. We just started building, finished the first boat right when I came on board. And then from there, we just created the whole process and started building. And Mike, being the awesome guy that he is, he really took me under his wing and took me fishing a bunch and taught me just a ton. I was on a fast learning curve for getting proficient at fly fishing stuff. And from there, it really took off. And then at the same time, my growth and knowledge with drift boats happened. And that's how Tracy Allen, one of the other founders of Adipose, he was the brains behind the design of the boats. And so I learned a ton about design and fiberglass and mold making and stuff from him. And then hand in hand with that, I learned a ton about fly fishing and just angling in general from Mike. And so it was a pretty cool opportunity, and I saw it and I just ran with it.
Nice. And then, so the company, well, I want to get into some of the background there on the history, you know, as far as the company, obviously, in the connection. But I want to go back to the Army piece quickly, because you jumped in when you were 17. And for me, you know, my story's a little different. I was kind of always, you know, although I love, you know, obviously my country and our country and stuff, I mean, I was always scared, kind of shitless of the Army. Never really wanted to. I knew that was one thing I didn't want to do. I mean, why for you did you feel like you had to go in even before you graduated from high school?
Oh, man, I was a pretty wild child. Definitely raised a lot of hell with my parents and just everything. And I was always a little bit different. I grew up in a family of four siblings, so six of us and stuff. And I had a teacher when I was in middle school that was in the National Guard. And then I had my grandpa was in World War II. Well, both my grandpas and my grandma on my mom's side were in World War II. And it just always kind of drew me in. To be completely honest, I like shooting guns and I like lighting stuff on fire and blowing stuff up. And so I was like, there's no better way to kind of go along with that and get paid for it. And so that was, I went in as a 19 Delta, which would be a Cav Scout. So on paper, our mission was reconnaissance, and you kind of go in, sneak around, find the enemy and report and stuff from there. And then we had some pretty cool weaponry, and it was, I like, in a lot of ways, I'm kind of a loner. So I like the small group aspect of the scouts versus bigger platoons and stuff with the infantry. And yeah, just again, the sneaking around. I've always been a hunter and a fisherman, and just kind of getting close to prey. And so that's kind of my deal. And yeah, and so I saw the opportunity, and I definitely knew that I was not going to college. That was biggest for me, is like, I barely graduated high school. I did the absolute minimum so that I could leave, because I hated it that much. But it was, so that was kind of just the natural path for me. And then I had two other buddies that we all joined the military at the same time, essentially. And we all just took a little bit different paths within the military. And but yeah, that's kind of how I ended up in it. I would have stuck with it for a lifetime career, but a couple things happened throughout my life that just made it where it wasn't going to work out. And so that's kind of why I got out in 2011 and
that's cool.
Went on. And really, the Adipose was a big factor in that too. Is I saw the opportunity here, and I loved Montana and stuff. So I decided to give up one career for hopefully another.
For another.
It seemed to work out.
That's awesome. And what was that? I think you mentioned the wild child. I think of myself, I've done some, when I was a kid, you know, the crazy stuff. I think we used to play like BB gun wars when we were little kids. But I mean, what was the craziest thing from your childhood that, you know, that you did that kind of,
Oh man, it was just a definitely BB gun wars, definitely building forts and stuff. I grew up in where I grew up in West Michigan. I pretty much grew up on a farm. So my uncle's farm was literally right across the street from me, from my parents' house and stuff. And then our house was surrounded by cornfields or soybean fields and alfalfa fields and stuff. And then from there we had woods all over the place. And I had a four wheeler and a dirt bike growing up too. That was really a lot of it was like, we'd build a big jump and then everyone kind of be standing around and they're like, who's going to hit it first? And
that's it.
Here I like, yeah, I'll go.
You're the one.
And then from there we had a pond across the street. And so they're like, well, we don't know if the ice is thick enough. Justin, go check it. So it's just like always being that guy that just would do that. There's the electric fence on. I don't know. Let's see. And then from there, and then in high school and stuff, I definitely was doing a lot of drinking and doing a lot of that stuff and just kind of went from there. But yeah, definitely always like fireworks and shooting guns and doing everything. So my parents could explain for hours about how they never slept.
So you managed to make it through, right? Without dying, you made it through, you know, you were that kid, you know, the crazy kid. I mean, what do you attribute that to? Like, was the army the thing that kind of got you straightened as far as like, you know, kept you safe, I guess? Well, safe is relative, right?
Yeah. I grew up in a pretty strict household in the sense that one, my parents they're always loving and caring, and they kept a close eye on me. And a part of that, I think, is just my personality. I rebelled again. And then also within that household, we were pretty religious. And so I just had a really good foundation. And so part of me just always was rebelling and always was fighting against the grain and going out and stuff. And then the military definitely let me vent a lot of that out. And so, because in the end, like where I'm at now, I never have to like think about like, what would have been like too, or I wonder what this was like, or wonder what, like, and so, cause I just did it all. And so I kind of just got it all out of my system. And then, once I quit drinking, I've been sober for 8 years now. Oh, cool. I quit drinking, when I was 25.
Yep.
And, that was a big part of it. And then also I had a daughter, adopted a daughter when I was in 2015. And so being a dad just kind of really grounded me. And then just the responsibility here at work and stuff. So it was definitely a combination of a ton of things. But one is I probably did enough crazy stuff for a lifetime's worth by the time I was 25. And then from there, the great foundation my parents gave me, and then just being a dad, like, well, as soon as I became a dad and started raising my daughter, it was like, this is it. I was pretty selfish person with my time, and and as soon as I started doing that, I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever done.
That's cool. Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about kids is that they. Yeah, I mean, it changes your focus, obviously. Probably, and maybe saves a lot of lives because it makes you realize, you can't keep going doing what you're doing or you're going to kill yourself. And you want to be around for your kids as much as possible to see them.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I've seen it, too, with a couple of my friends that we were on the same path and stuff. And then the ones that didn't have kids continued down that path in a sense. And then, and then some that did have kids kind of continued down that path. And then they straightened out, but then there's other ones. As soon as their kid was born, it's like the switch went on, and it was different.
Yeah, I know, and I don't want to go down too deep down this hole of death and stuff. But we had a friend whose kid. I mean, I guess he was like 17. I mean, he just died, recently, and we think it was partly pill related. I think he took some Vicodin or something off the street that had some, whatever the stuff they put on it, but just didn't wake up, man. You know, I mean, a 17-year-old kid, pretty normal kid. Right. And, so it's those things that get me thinking about my kids, like, oh man, it's like, not only do you have to keep them alive when they're young, but there's a lot. And I remember it as well, right? I remember the bad kids. I remember that time where I got around the few of my friends in that high school period where it was like, man, these are not the right kids. And I was getting into trouble. And it's so, yeah, it's the, who you're around is a big part of it. But,
yeah, definitely that. But like, I think too, like just even this, quickly talking to you about it, like I think, like you can tell that you care about your kids and their future, and that's something you think about. And so what I've really noticed is like some of the friends and some of the people that I knew in high school that haven't been able to straighten their lives out and just keep struggling. It's like they just didn't have that foundation with their that love and care from their parents from the get-go. And so they've kind of always been fighting on their own and don't have that mentorship that it is. Because when you're young, like you don't want to listen to that stuff that your parents are telling you, but it's still
there.
It's planting those seeds in there. Yeah.
That's so right.
That's a big part of it.
I remember when I was getting in trouble, and my dad, who, he was kind of strict, but he came up to me. He didn't say much, but he just said, he didn't even tell me to stop, but he just said, you need to think about who you're hanging out with. And, and that's all he said. And it took me a little while, but like a year later or whatever it was, I realized, oh God, he was exactly right. I was with the wrong kid. So man, hey, this has been, I love hearing the background. I mean, obviously this is setting the stage for, you're involved with, Adipose now, and I want to dig into that. So I love getting a little background on your story there. Maybe we could start off with, talking about Adipose. Obviously you mentioned Tracy and I mentioned, I've had a couple people in the Facebook group note Tracy's name as well. Maybe talk about that. Can you bring us back to how the boat, maybe a little bit of how the company got started?
Yeah. So Tracy Allen was, again, he's one of the founders of the company. He's got a pretty unique story himself. He originally was from North Carolina, and he moved out here. It's got to be out west, like almost 40 years ago now, or over 40 years ago. And he kind of landed in the Belgrade area. And he had a mechanical engineer background, and he was a machinist in North Carolina, and went to college for mechanical engineering stuff. And he, as soon as he came out here and was fishing and started guiding almost right away. And he's just a tinker, and he very much like it's his way or the highway, and there he can tell you what's wrong with everything. And so he would get a boat and he wouldn't like the design very much, and so he would cut things and change things and just manipulate them a little bit to for his style and what he thought would make it row better and stuff. And so he did that for a number of years. And then he, at one point, started to make some aluminum boats, and those were called, I want to say they're called Metalheads.
He made an actual company. There was an actual company he created.
Yeah, he was involved in an actual company called Metalhead Drifters. We have one sitting on the lot here. I want to say they were partly made in Oregon, Pacific Northwest area. And that was, those were like his first iterations of a skiff design. As you probably know, and a lot of people don't know, like pretty much all that was around was dories, right? And so dories were just your traditional dory, traditional drift boat, big flared sides, big rocker, front to back and stuff, pointy bow, pretty narrow transom. And so he was doing that, and then got out involved in that company, stopped being involved in that company. And then while he was in Belgrade, he came up with another design, and he started another company called High Country Drifters. There's actually a new company in North Carolina, funny enough, that's called High Country Drifters now. And they make a kind of a skiff hybrid traditional boat with some similar designs to our current boat. Tracy has nothing to do with that, but they started kind of a handful of years ago. But yeah, so High Country Drifters, Tracy built his own molds and plugs from that. And so to a lot of people that doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but that's where all the money is, and the whole company lies in like what your molds and plugs are. Cause that's where it's just a reversal of what your boat's going to be. So whatever your plug looks like is what your mold's going to look like. And whatever your mold looks like is exactly what your boat's going to look like.
And what is the plug?
So the plug is how you make your first mold. It's so backwards how you do this process. But essentially what you very first do is you make something that is going to look like your final part, and it's pretty temporary. So whether it's a seat box or a tackle storage lid or something bigger like your boat hull, you make what your hull is going to look like
out of fiberglass.
Yep. Out of fiberglass. Well, no, this is no. You make it out of like whatever you can find that's workable. That, because this is the big thing. This is how you create your actual shape. So most of the time you make it out of like MDF. And so it's just like particle board that you stick a bunch of Bondo on and you smooth it out, and then you spray it with like a sandable primer. And so that's where, like, when you look at a plug, it would be what would look exactly like an upside down boat. And so you make this temporary plug, you get it as close as you can to your final shape and final smoothness and stuff. Because when we pop a boat, like once we're all done making plugs and molds and everything, and we pop a boat out of the mold, we don't do anything to it. The reason why it gets that glossy, shiny finish is because that's what your mold looks like. And the only reason your mold looks like that is because that's what your plugs looked like.
And how is a mold different than a plug?
So your mold is your reversal of your plug, right? So your plug looks like a flipped over boat. Your mold looks like an empty bathtub. That is the shape of your boat.
Gotcha.
And it's shiny and glossy on the inside. And again, that's what you lay. So you make your temporary plug, then you pull hopefully a good mold off of it. And when I say pull, so that's where you go from like MDF to in that those temporary materials to your mold, which is going to where you're going to build all your parts out of. that needs to be extremely sound and strong and no wavies in it, nothing that's going to cause any issues. So that is usually made out of vinyl ester resin. One tooling gel, which is it's like gel coat, but a lot harder. And then vinyl ester resin and GP resin. And then you build like a bunch of structure around the outside, like some sort of like rib system to stiffen it up. And you pop that off your plug. And so that is working. Normally, because the plug was temporary to begin with, you can get lucky and you can pull another mold off of your plug or another couple molds, your first plug. But normally your very first plug is kind of going to be junk. And so you then out of your mold, you pull a final plug out of. That's like your master key. Once you have that final plug, you can make as many molds, which then can make as many boats as you would ever want to make, or whatever part it may be, whether it's a car hood or a seat box or a casting brace or you name it.
And this is the fiberglass. This is obviously the fiberglass. This would be different than if you're making a wood boat or aluminum boat or, you know, whatever, but it's, you know, it's interesting because it sounds like there's, you know, I don't know, obviously, you know, much about it, but it sounds like it's an extra step there that that's hard to understand why you wouldn't just start with the mold. But I guess that's mainly. And why is that? I guess why couldn't you? I'm getting, you know, again, I don't want to stick on this too long, but just clarifying the plug and mold. You know, you have one that's upside down, one that's right side up. What is the big, why couldn't you just start with a the mold? Is it just because one's inside?
Because you can't just shape that final mold, like we talked about, is that hard vinyl ester tooling gel and stuff. You can't shape that. Once that's made, it's made. It's solid. You can shape your plug.
That's what it is. Okay.
Yeah. So you have to be able to shape. And when I like, it's. It sounds complicated, and it is. It almost sounds easy, but it's definitely not. It's very, very. It's very meticulous. Like you're sitting there at first, and you're putting on layers of 32nd inch thick Bondo and sanding it and building it up and shaping and doing. And so every little curve and every little thing. And once it's done, like if you look down the side and you made a couple waves in it, then the refraction is going to be all look weird and stuff. And so it's very, very difficult. And so that's why when I kind of mentioned that Tracy made his own plug and mold, that it was pretty big thing for him to do on his own, and to do it in just in like a garage in outside of Belgrade area. And so that company that he started there, High Country Drifters, he ended up building 16 fiberglass boats. He had a couple people that helped him here and there, just random buddies. But for the most part, he built them all on his own. And this was back before, like now we have what we call chopper guns, and we can get into that later. But like he was hand batching everything. So he's using 1 gallon buckets and he's pouring resin in, he's pouring catalyst in, mixing it together, dumping it on the fiberglass, squeegeeing it out and stuff. So it was very, very labor intensive for what it was. And at the same time, he was guiding full time. Then during the winters, his whole thing is steelhead, swinging for steelhead over on the Clearwater. Yep. And so that's kind of what his life revolved around. He did that again from, that was like late 80s, early 90s. And that was like a very, very, that's like generation one of the Adipose flow right now, like very, very similar design. And one of the first skiffs on the market, in a lot of ways.
So that was the High Country Drifters. Those were kind of more skiffs. So you guys, and today, are you still, I mean, the boats, most of the ones you see look more like a skiff than a dory. Is that still the case?
Yeah. Yep. So we've always just kind of grown, taken that skiff design. Cause we have some opinions about why skiffs are better for what we do, for what most trout fishermen do. We think that a skiff design is going to be better, especially out in these Rocky Mountain states. And so at that same time, like there was around that time, that's when like Koffler skiffs were coming out. That's when the South Fork skiff came out and the High Country skiff. And so it was, that was like really when you started to late '80s, early '90s. That's when you started to see these skiffs hit the market.
So the High Country Drifters, that was in the late '80s. He had that company going.
Yeah, I want to say late '80s or I don't know exactly what year, but yeah, definitely in there is when, because he also before it, in between the metal boats and during the fiberglass boats, before he made his first plugs, he made a handful or at least two wood boats also. And so those wood boats is really where he, because wood is a lot easier to manipulate and just kind of like you're saying, like why, when you're asking like, well, why don't you guys just go with this? Like that's what with wood you can, like you just say, okay, this is my design. You start manipulating the wood. And then once you're done, that's your final thing. Like you don't have to then make something off of that.
So basically Tracy had, obviously I think you said, was it 2010 Adipose boat, the actual company started? Was that correct?
Yeah, November 9th of 2009 was when Mike and Tracy walked into what now is our office space and area, and that's when the legwork kind of started a little bit before that, but then really we didn't start building until 2010.
Okay, so 2010. So basically, but there's a huge history of Mike and Tracy getting building up to that, you know, almost probably 20, 30 years of before Adipose is launched. So that makes sense. And then on the skiff, so that design of the skiff, if you just take it, we know where the design of the drift boat, the Dory, came from. I mean, it came from I've got a whole episode on the history of drift boats with Roger Fletcher, and he talked about how that started back on the Mackenzie and Rogue, you know, with the two different styles of drift boats. But the skiff is quite a bit different. Where does that design, you know, can you attribute that to some person or some series of boats?
I don't know if you can really attribute to one person. I think that there's someone out there that might try to claim it, but I think it more than anything, it was born out of necessity by a few different people at the same time. Because out when I say like Rocky Mountain states, like I'm talking Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, Utah, like kind of this vein that goes through the country along the front in a way, and in the middle of the Rocky Mountain, where we have rivers that are more mellow than a lot of the stuff on the Pacific Northwest, maybe, where it just drops like crazy amounts of elevation fast. Yeah. Or same thing where maybe like versus Colorado, where it drops crazy amount of elevation super fast. And so you have a lot of rapids and like big, big rapids. Yeah. And so we don't have as big of rapids. Like if you float somewhere here and you touch legit class three rapids and you're fishing for trout, like that's pretty big deal. Like here, just you don't do that. But it's windy all the time. It's just when those guys came out here, the guides that came from weather that they came from, like Tracy, he came from North Carolina and the Mackenzie era over there, and then you have the guys in the Pacific Northwest that are doing the steelhead and those fisheries and stuff and those but other boats you talked about, and then they come out here and the design worked, but you're just getting blown around like a leaf on the water. And so that's where the skiff was kind of born. It's like they need something that can handle the wind but also handle the really shallow rivers that we have and the big ebbs and flows from runoff to late season in these freestones, and then from there, fishing to anglers that are actually fishing, not just like sitting, going from spot to spot and stuff. And so it was just like a combination of things. And, but yeah, this, like the South Fork skiff with Paul Brune and those guys that did that. And then Tracy with the High Country Drifter and stuff, like it definitely, I've heard someone reference it in the past one time when I was in a fly tying class, he was talking about how he came up with this certain way to tie an Alcaraz caddis. And he was the first person, he was pretty famous, making videos, going all along the world, teaching classes, stuff. And he was the first person that he saw or that he knew of that did this technique. But then he went to the East Coast and he was at another seminar and he saw someone else do the same thing. And so he said in what he was talking about, he's like, yeah, you may be the first person that you know of that done it and you can try to claim it. But like, there's multiple people at one time that are going down the same parallel paths. And it may be a few weeks or months different. And in that time before media and the way the internet is now, it's like you would never know.
That's the interesting thing I'm trying to get to is on that. As far as the skiff, it sounds like if you go pre-80s or whatever, how far would you have to go back to where you wouldn't see a river skiff on it sounds like they're mostly focused on kind of the area there in the Rockies, or you know, I guess out towards the Michigan and the Great Lakes as well. But, you know, could you go back, say, to 1970 and not see a single skiff design like you guys build?
Yeah, I would say so, unless you, like, count, like, an Asabo boat as a skiff. I don't know if you know what that
is. No.
You don't know what that is? Yeah, so they're, like, a really long canoe that you pull with super low sides.
What's it called? It's called an Asabo skiff.
So AU and then space and then SABL, I believe, Asabo. And so there's an Asabo River in Michigan, and that was like, and so it's like a Ginu. Do you know what a Ginu is?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, yeah. So they're very interesting. Once you put those, like, I hope people pull them up and look at them. Like in Michigan, guys still outfit and guide from them. They are super unique, and rivers there are so shallow.
Gotcha.
that you don't really, you can paddle them a little bit, but they almost like pull them like a flat skiff.
I'll put a link in the show notes to one. I'm looking at it now. It looks, yeah. I mean, it basically looks like a mix between a canoe and a drift boat. Kind of,
yeah. And so those, like Asabo boats have been, I don't even know when the first one of those was made, but that probably predates 1970.
I gotcha.
But so it's just kind of like iterations where you just constantly, but I to your, those, there's no way those would work out here.
No, they would tip over.
Even in like a class one rapid,
yeah.
Or it just anything like those, they're just specifically like the Asabo River is a very, very
you don't see
narrow, mellow river there.
That makes sense. That makes sense. That's cool. Well, there's another episode as I go down on this drift boat season. I think that's going to be the problem. Like a lot of these things, I'm going to run out of time to cover all the topics because that would be interesting, right? Northern Michigan fly fishing.
It's a huge deal there too. Those guys, they're definitely going to be a lot of resources and people to talk to there and stuff.
That's cool. Well, let's bring it back to, you know, I wanted to touch on fiberglass as well, because, you know, I've had a few guests already on, I've had Koffler on, we've talked about the aluminum boats and the connection there. But, you know, and there's some big players in the drift boat, you know, Clackacraft, Hyde. There's a whole bunch of big fiberglass boats. What are the advantages of, and I'm not sure, it sounds like you've been in a few boats, but if you think about the fiberglass boat, what's the advantages of a fiberglass, say, over a aluminum or wood or maybe even like a plastic, you know, like a boulder boat sort of thing?
Well, first I'll talk about the other types of materials.
Yeah.
So with aluminum, right? When I'm going through my elevator speech and talking through someone and they ask me about aluminum, my opinion about aluminum is it's hot when it's hot out, it's cold when it's cold out,
yeah.
And it's loud all the time.
That's
so
true.
It's like they're extremely durable. They're it, But after that, like, they're harder in some ways to, like, manipulate certain things, unless, because you can't, again, there's no mold for anything versus fiberglass. So you have to, like, individually piece together every part and weld it and bend it and put it in a break and do all this. And so it gets pretty difficult to make something pretty intricate in aluminum boats and stuff. And they have their place. Like, I know for sure, like, out in the Pacific Northwest, where you are banging off rocks all day long and stuff, like, you need something that's going to be more durable than some fiberglass boats.
Yeah.
And then, so quickly to move from there to wood. Wood is the maintenance is just crazy.
Yeah.
Like, every winter you're bringing that thing inside, you're sanding it down, you're varnishing it, you're doing this, you're doing that. And so it's like, it's the upkeep, they're beautiful, they're amazing and stuff. So upkeep, not really ideal. And then we go into plastic. Plastic has some of the limitations as the same that aluminum's going to have with different molding and different things where you're going to have to piece it all together. Yes, you can build a mold to inject this or inject that, but building a mold for plastic injection is very expensive. Hmm. And so you're kind of stuck with, like, okay, more simpler designs and stuff. And it's also very expensive. Like, Boulder Boatworks makes a beautiful boat, and they do they kind of mix the old with the new, and the fact that they do the wood with the plastic and stuff. So they have a really unique feel and stuff to them. And then they also have, like, their convertible river taxi or CRT, which has the aluminum framing inside of it and stuff. And so that's, but again, like, cost wise, it's just, it's very expensive. Very, very expensive.
Gotcha.
So with fiberglass, once you have your molds, it's pretty easy to work with. Like, you can make it, you can mold it, you can lay it pretty fast, you can get really good consistency. The material's not that expensive. The most expensive thing by far in our whole process is our labor. Our boats are very, very labor intensive, but the actual material itself is not that expensive. And then once the boat's made, the upkeep is pretty simple. Like, it's really, like, I can tell boats, and I see a lot of used boats. We do a lot of repairs. I can tell immediately if a boat was covered or not. I can tell immediately if a boat was washed regularly or not.
So the fiberglass boat, that's one of the things you definitely, it's similar to, I've had some oars. I've never had a fiberglass boat, but I've had oars that were fiberglass that I left outdoors. And like, the fiberglass, eventually you wouldn't want to touch it with your arm. Otherwise you get fiberglass in your arm because I guess the protective coating wore off. Is the drift boat different than that? Like, what would happen if you left it outside for a couple of years?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot different than that, because you're probably talking about some cataract oars.
Exactly.
I had this exact conversation with a guy yesterday.
Oh, really?
Called me and asked me why, when he gets near his boat, he gets itchy. And I said, it's not your boat, it's your oars. Because with the boat, it's not, you can leave them out. Don't get me wrong. You can leave them outside for decades. And as long as the water's draining out of it, you're going to pretty much be all right.
Yeah.
The biggest thing that I see is you're going to get sun, just like a car, right? Like, you can park a car outside or you can park it in the garage. But if you leave a car outside after 10 years, it's going to be sun fade. There's going to be haze. There's going to be a bunch of stuff that are starting to get wear and tear on it.
Will it be a little weaker? Will the actual boat be, like, if you hit a rock, would it be a weaker? Not that, I mean, I think it makes sense to keep your boats inside when you can, obviously. But I'm just getting back to that point of, you know, I think an aluminum boat, not that any one is better than the other, but aluminum, you could just leave outside for like 30 years and it wouldn't matter because it's just.
I don't think again, as long as water's draining out of it and it's not like just sitting there filling up like a bathtub, the glass wouldn't get weaker.
Yeah.
Just nothing that's noticeable.
Gotcha.
For like a 30-year span and stuff.
and that's pushing it a little bit. But, you know, I mean, I just want to get to the point, you know, on the fiberglass, if somebody comes in and they're thinking, okay, you know, I want to buy a boat. And again, not that anyone's better. They all have great features. But, you know, what is the pitch on the fiberglass boat? If you say like the top five benefits of the fiberglass, you know, your guys' boat, and you can even throw that, the fact that it's a skiff. I think Boulder, we talked about their skiff, low sides, helps with the wind, you know, and all the features. So that's great. But if you talk about just fiberglass, what are the, have you talked about those benefits, the costs? You have a lower cost, anything
yeah,
else?
Yeah, so you're landing in the middle of the road. It costs where it's expensive, but it's not like crazy. It's the great thing is about it is it's not easy, but you can repair it fairly easy. So like no matter what, yeah. as long as water's draining out of it and you don't let it get to the point where everything's delaminating, like we refinish bottoms of boats all the time.
Oh, cool.
And we repaint interiors and stuff. Like we've taken 30-year-old fiberglass boats, legitimately 30-year-old fiberglass boats, and done a full refurbish on them and brought them back to where they look brand new and they're as sound or more sound than they were brand new and stuff. So as long as you take care of it, it's always going to be there. It's easier to make molds and more intricate parts and stuff because you can bend, and because when all of our fiberglass is raw, it literally just feels like some of it just feels like a t-shirt or like a rug that you would lay on the floor. And you can manipulate it however you want when it's in that raw form. And then once the chemical reaction happens between the resins and the catalyst, then it becomes hard. So we can make really intricate rod trays and tackle storage lids and stuff and casting braces. And we can change designs fairly frequently and easier. So it's just, there's a ton of benefits, and a lot of it is, so 75% of our clients are guides, and those guides, they're looking at this like, I need this to last me in between 2 and 5 years. Like that doesn't seem like a very long amount of time, but like me as a dude that works in an office all day, if I go and float 50 times a year, I'm doing awesome. For a guide around here, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho and stuff, like they're doing 150 to 200 days a year. If you're a full-time guide that's doing it. So that in one, it's going to take me I'll fish a lot. Like a random person, if they float 20 times a year, they're doing good. So it could take them 10 years to put in what a guide might do in one season. And so guides are looking to get their investment, to make money off of it, turn around, flip it, not be too much into repairing it and so on and so forth. And so that's kind of why fiberglass has been the most popular with clack hides. So the lack of maintenance needed, the cheaper cost, and then the overall durability.
And then also the fact that, yeah, I mean, you're going down a trout stream. You don't want to be banging and making a lot of noise and these things kind of, and also they bend, right? A little bit, flex over rocks so they can slide through like shallower water. That's the, you know, the clack, I guess that's what they talk a lot about, the fact that it can kind of, you know, and it does, the floor bends as you're going down.
I was just going to say, yeah. So we try to ride this fine line of design to where it's going to flex enough, but not be too flexy, because if your boat's flexing a lot, then you're losing power when you're rowing. Right. Mm. So you want your boat to be stiff enough where it's maintaining power. And then also fiberglass it likes to flex, but it doesn't like to flex where there's hard points where parts tie into the floors or the sides or different things like that. And so that's where, we try to, like, we use core materials to stiffen up our bottom. So when you're walking around in them, it doesn't feel like a waterbed or a trampoline and stuff, because it still will slide over rocks, but also you're going to get a lot more life out of it because it's stiff enough in the bottom and your hard points, tie-in points aren't breaking.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Well, let's, Sean, before we get out of here, I want to touch on accessories and maybe a little on the fishing. What are the, as far as accessories, what are some of the popular, you know, like when you get one of your skiffs, what does that, you know, what are the options? What do people typically love to add to that? Are there, I mean, you mentioned the rod holders, are there other things, if you say a kind of a list of those?
Yeah, so with our boats, we have a pretty unique design where we have rod trays. So our instead of sticking them, our rods in a tube that bend down the side of the boat, there's a flat tray with a reel seat that where the rods lay on their sides, and you just pick one up, set one down. Very easy to change, switch from one rod to another. And so we get a lot of guys that will put rod tray foam in there. It's just like we call it, it's like a high density foam. That it helps protect rods and stuff, and then so people can transport with rods in there.
Oh, gotcha.
We do rubber mats on the floors where the anglers stand, because you're just again with guides, clients, whoever. You're going to get people that show up with cleats. At least,
oh yeah,
you could let them in the boat and say, "Don't move off that mat," and you're not going to destroy everything. And then motor mounts and covers, and one thing that's kind of unique to us is our boats are very versatile and changeable with like our casting brace legs and tops removed, so you can make it a true sit down boat like we're talking about with keeping quiet. You also want to keep a low profile, because out here, like, we're stone's throw away from the Missouri River, just amazing Blue River trout stream for dry fly fishing. And if you try to stand up and cast at those fish in late July, like, not going to happen unless you can make an accurate 60 foot reach cast. Yep. Like, if you want to get people that like your normal angler on it, 30 foot reach cast and sneaking up on them and stuff. And so that's a big thing with us. And then from there, since we have these removable parts and pieces, we've created casting platforms, which are really cool. Platforms that go in the front and the back of the boat that elevate from where the angler's standing on the floor of the boat to now standing about 2 feet taller to up on top of the boat, which kind of contradicts what I just said about keeping a lower profile. But the reason why we made those is we call them the casting platform, but I call it the carp deck, because I'm like huge into carp fishing. So is the owner, Mike Ward, and founder Tracy. So we use it for sight fishing, where you can sneak across the carp flats and go out there. A lot of times too, like, we'll use them out on still water, on lakes early in the morning, where you get gulpers out. The fish are just chasing around and eating off the surface, and so you can see them from a long ways out and put a cast out in front of them and stuff. So that's a really cool feature. We do net holders, spare oar holders. I had a guy he's coming to pick up his boat on Thursday. He wanted like a bimini top, and so what I ended up doing was I found a beach umbrella that you can twist in the middle, like lean back and forth. And so we made it where you take out a rear casting brace leg, you stick in that, the base of the beach umbrella, which has a button, a push button, like our normal casting brace legs, and goes from there. And then he has it where now, because he fishes up on Hebgen Lake a bunch and for gulpers there, and some days just getting beat down by the sun. And so just hiding out from that.
Yeah.
So it's just really like, people come all the time and say, "Can you do?" And immediately I say, "We can do anything. It's just what's your budget?" And then,
Cool. And what about as far as buying a boat? I mean, if somebody, obviously, somebody can buy a boat from you. I'm not sure. What if somebody was in the market looking around? And as far as used boats, do you have any tips on, you know, if somebody wanted, if didn't have quite the money to get a brand new, where they might start?
Yeah. So we sell used boats ourselves. Mm-hmm. So they're all listed on our website. That's really the best. If you're looking for one of our boats, that's going to be the best spot to look is either like the Craigslist around Helena area or around Montana, or on our website, 'cause that's where we list them. And really, you don't see very many of our boats just being sold outright. Like, most of the used boats that you see from that are in Adipose, they're being sold by us because a guy traded in and got a new one, like we talked about with that 2 to 5 year span thing. And there's very few people that actually get one, have it for a number of years, and then just sell it. Most people, they just love the boat that much that they hold on to it. So we kind of control the used market in that sense. But if you're wherever you're at, just kind of looking on Craigslist and stuff and keep perusing. I know east of the Mississippi, it gets really, really hard to find drift boats because really there's only stealth craft in Michigan
that stealth.
Makes boats. And then over there, and then there is that high country boats. But it's just automatically I see boats that get east of the Mississippi, their value goes up by $1,000 or $2,000 because it's so much more difficult to get a boat there. If I was you, like, do you want me to give pointers on, like, if someone was to, like, if they're going to look at a used boat, to look at?
That'd be great. Yeah. If somebody comes up, let's say they're just out there, they see an ad on, or they see something in whatever, right? The paper, or the Facebook, and it's like, oh, this looks like a nice boat. Let's go meet and check it out. So they go to the boat and they're in front of it. They could touch it. Well, yeah. What do they need to know about a fiberglass boat to know if it's good?
So a couple things. One is, like we kind of discussed earlier, is they're pretty easy to repair and work on. And so don't get like too caught up on certain things with the bottom being scratched up or whatever, because for $600 to $800, you can get the bottom completely refinished depending on where you go. But really what I would look for is look where I call them the tie-in points. And I kind of mentioned this earlier. Mm-hmm. With our design, but anywhere, whether it be a casting brace, whether it be a seat box, whether it be a bench, whether it be a rod holder, anywhere where that part meets the hull of the boat, take a good look at those tie-in points, because that's where, again, like as the boat's flexing, normally those tie-in points are going to be going opposite direction of what the regular flex would be. And so that's where you'll get what we call stress cracking. And it will look like a spider cracking like in a window or something like that. But those points, if it's bad enough, though, that means that those parts are about to fall out. Like they literally, like I've had it where guys brought casting brace from a certain manufacturer here, and you pull on the front casting brace and the whole front cap just comes off the boat. And so things like that, where if you're just look, like when you first go to look at it, people just, especially if it's your first boat, a boat's a boat, right? You go look, they don't know what anything is. Look at those points, make sure that nothing's like drastic there. You can always shoot me some photos. I don't care if it's another manufacturer's boat, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like we do a lot of repairs and stuff. So shoot me some photos and say, what do you think about this? And then I'll say, yeah, nothing to really worry about, whatever. Or that's a big deal and stuff. And then do crawl under the boat and look and make sure that there's no what we call delamination. So most of your hand-laid fiberglass boats, Hyde, Clack, Roe, us, you're going to use multiple layers to create your actual hull. And if the boats had too much flex or too much abuse, you can get delamination where those layers are actually separating. And then there'll be spots where water can seep in between those layers. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And so really look out for that. And most of the time that's going to be maybe dead center in the middle of the floor or along the chines. And the chines is where the bottom comes up and creates the side, front to back. So really watch out for that. And then from there, just like making sure seats are good and stuff. And no matter what, unless you bought it from someone like us that is gone through the boat and made it whatever pre-owned certified, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Go get the axle checked immediately.
Oh yeah.
Because that's a huge thing. Like every season I end up selling multiple people brand new axles for reasons that could have been easily prevented with just checking and replacing bearings. Spend the $120 to get your bearings repacked and replaced and stuff. It's well worth the investment, because on your way to your once a year or twice a year or three times a year fishing trip and being stuck in a Walmart parking lot in Podunk nowhere
That's a great tip.
And so that's a big one.
And that's the trick. And what do you guys use? you know, who's the company that makes your trailers, or what do you guys have out there?
So our trailers are made by Black Dog Trailers out of Bancroft, Idaho. It's a design that's proprietary to us. We, Tracy and Mike, designed it together. And then they, so he welds them up and brings them to the galvanizing plant. And then we just get stacks of frames essentially. And then from there, we put the axles and the tires and the bunks and the rollers and all those things on. We assemble and build all that stuff ourselves here.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Cool. Well, I guess, yeah, maybe the fishing piece, we're probably going to dig into that on a, well, we've talked a lot about fishing, so I wanted to touch on the Adipose. I think that was interesting. Anything else before we get out of here? Anything, you know, for Adipose the next 6 months or so you want to give a heads up on?
No, not too much with design stuff right now. We're constantly, I get a lot of people like, well, what's the difference between a 2020 and 2019? Or we're just constantly always improving. One thing is that I think we're really, really good as we're always listening to our customers, always listening to that guide feedback of those customers of ours that are spending those 150 to 200 days on the water every year and saying, hey man, like you guys need to do something about this, and actually taking it to heart and doing that. So that there's always little nuances between the years that we've changed to make them better and better. We don't just sit back on our laurels and our name and be like, oh, we're Adipose. Like we're yeah. established now. We're always hungry. We always want to be leading the pack in innovation and stuff. And so, yeah, just kind of that stuff is what we're working on right now. Nothing too big there. Cool. Yeah. And then I think the only other real thing with Adipose, we didn't touch on too much, but just with Mike Ward, the owner, how he found Tracy and stuff. But yeah, Mike was also a guide, found one of Tracy's high country boats, and that's really how Adipose was born. Was
gotcha.
From that
yeah
action stuff. But
yeah, cool.
Yeah,
cool,
we're always innovating and trying to stay ahead of the curve, and like I said, listen to our customers and
awesome.
Fix the issues that they see.
That's awesome. Cool, man. All right, Justin, well, adipose boatworks.com is the best place to find you guys.
Yeah, that's our website. And then adiposeboatworks@gmail.com is our email, and pretty small operation in the sense that just we have 14 employees and two
yeah.
of me included in our office manager. So if you send an email to that, I'll be sure to see it. And
yeah. I think 14 employees. I was just interviewing Ken Morish with Flywater Travel, I think, earlier this week. And yeah, I mean, I think they have 14 employees, right? Same thing. And they're one of the big travel companies around. So it seems like, you know, fly fishing, right? We talk about this. It's a small space, and 14 employees is probably, I don't know if it's the average, but that's, you're probably in the medium size. Would you say company-wise, like numbers, like kind of more medium or small? To
yeah.
Medium?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely depends on what you're, I think with the size of like drift boat companies and stuff, like when you compare us to whether it be the people that are within our realm, I would say Row,
yeah.
Boulder Boat, Stealthcraft, like maybe Koffler and stuff, that's probably average. And then Hyde and Clackercraft, they're in a whole nother level
right.
than us. And so who knows how many employees they
yeah.
have, but they,
yeah.
they're definitely cranking out. We're building about 80 to 85 boats a year right now, and they're probably doing closer to 200.
200, which still, I mean, I think that's what Boulder said too, and it still sounds like 85 boats is you know, I mean, that's not too far behind, you know, 200. So, but I do have, Clack and hopefully Hyde will get both of those, get them on as well before we wrap up with this drift boat season. But
yeah.
Cool, man. Well, hey, I appreciate your time and sharing some little insight into the history of Adipose and, you know, some tips. I think we touched on a little bit of everything. So, yeah, man, we'll keep in touch with you and check back with you soon.
Sounds good, Dave. Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on here and letting me tell my story and tell Adipose's story.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes with all the links we cover, just go to wetflyswing.com/187. Also, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/travel to find out which new trips we have coming up for this this coming year. Hopefully all things are back on with travel, and we'll be hitting some pretty killer locations. So check it out there.
I want to just thank you again for stopping by today. Check out the show. I know you have a ton of podcast choices out there and appreciate your support and the listen today. Looking forward to catching up with you soon. Hope to maybe see you online or on the river.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.